Okay, folks, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 212 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the Family Medicine Shelf Review Series. This will be series 3, and I'll be focusing on GI. And I know there's a lot of people that have kind of sent me requests about, like, when I plan to finish these Family Medicine podcasts. I'll try my very best and try to make as many as possible that will be helpful for the shelf and also for step 2 CK. So I will just try to hit on the highest yield topics first, and then I'll begin to go after the lower yield ones as time goes on. So let's just jump right into it. So I'll say basically today, in terms of GI, I think the best way to treat GI is to talk about the other stuff and then talk about the liver. So today I'm going to focus on the liver, like the liver and all its pathologies and all the biliary whatevers, because that makes up probably like almost half of the GI material that presents on the Family Medicine Shelf. So let's jump right into it. So the first thing on MBME exams you want to differentiate is, you want to ask yourself, is a disease hepatocellular in nature or is it cholestatic in nature? What do I mean by that? The thing is, a cholestatic pattern of liver disease is usually a liver disease where you have the ALK force disproportionately elevated compared to the AST and ALT. And then a hepatocellular pattern of liver disease is when you have the AST and ALT being elevated disproportionately compared to the ALK force, right? Although remember, as a surrogate for ALK force, you can also use the GGT, gamma glutamyl transferase. That's also a pretty useful test in to tell you that you're dealing with some kind of cholestatic liver disease. So, I mean, again, if you see like this hepatocellular pattern, people have like super high AST, ALTs. That's usually caused by like, you know, like a viral hepatitis. Or you can see people have like drug-induced liver injury, like from acetaminophen. Again, remember, acetaminophen is not an NSAID. That's a common mistake people make on exams. No one really knows how acetaminophen works. It's just a fever reducer. So that's something you want to keep in mind. And then if you see an AST to ALT ratio greater than 2, right, you're probably thinking about some kind of alcoholic hepatitis, right? And whenever you see a person that has acute liver disease, like acute liver injury, and you notice that their clotting labs are beginning to get out of whack, so like their PTINR is getting all screwed up, their albumin is getting decreased and all that badness, then you want to begin to worry about maybe referring those people for liver transplant. Basically, once the liver's like kind of like synthetic function, like PTINR, PTT begin to get out of whack, that's an ominous sign, right? So that's something you need to watch out for in tests. And then, again, cholestatic pattern of liver disease, the thing that will happen for the most part is those people will have, again, elevated ALK force, they'll have elevated direct bilirubin, right? Proportionally, their AST, ALT will be much lower. And again, usually you need to have problems like in the biliary tree to have these kinds of problems, right? And then obviously if a person has like hemolytic anemia of any sort, right? Or if they have like a UDP GT problem, they'll have like increases in indirect bilirubin. So again, those are all things to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has like a mild upper respiratory infection or is just had a surgery, and then they have like, you know, like mild jaundice, mild indirect hyperbilirubinemia. What's your diagnosis? Well, I hope you're thinking about Gilbert syndrome, right? Gilbert syndrome, remember, it's like decreased activity of UDPGT. So whenever you have decreased activity of UDPGT, right, you will not be able to convert indirect bilirubin to direct bilirubin, so you'll have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. And remember that Gilbert syndrome is not treated, right? It's not treated. It's for the most part, it's symptomatic. They will just, whenever they are stressed or they get like a mild sickness, they get like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. So that's fine. That's not a huge issue. We don't treat it. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, maybe traveled to Mexico and then came back, and this person, you know, has like, you know, pretty severe like right upper quadrant pain. The AST, ALT like is in the thousands. If you see that, what are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like Hep A, right? Like acute Hep A infection. Remember, Hep A doesn't cause chronic infection, right? And I mean, Hep A is actually vaccine preventable. That's why, like, if you're traveling to an endemic area or you're an IV drug user, right, or a person has like cirrhosis, like chronic liver disease, or has like one of those hemophilias, or if there's like if you're a man that has sex with other men, those people actually do need the Hep A vaccine, right? That's a common exam question you want to be aware of. And again, if a person is given the Hep A vaccine, then you essentially decrease the risk of them contracting Hep A in the first place. And remember that Hep A, for the most part, right, like, you know, the way we'll present it will be like super acute onset. Patient will be fatigued, they'll have like jaundice, they'll have nausea, they'll have vomiting. Their AST, ALT is usually above 1,000 on MBME exams, right? And again, the way that they will present it in the test, they'll give you this kind of presentation and they ask for your next step in diagnosis. Just go ahead and check for the anti-Hep A virus IgM, okay? Because remember, IgM is what is elevated in a person that has a acute infection, right? And then if we're getting to the other hepatitis, right, like Hep B, right? Hep B, for the most part, right, what are some classic things they like to test on exams? Obviously, it's vaccine preventable. I mean, if a child is born in the hospital, before the child leaves the hospital, the child should get the Hep B vaccine. And another classic question we see is if a person gets like a needle stick from Hep B, right? You want to give them the Hep B vaccine and also the Hep B immune globulin, right? But the thing is, if a person already has a history of Hep B vaccination, then you don't need to do any kind of post-exposure prophylaxis, okay? That's a high yield thing to keep in mind. Let's say like they tell you that, oh, this person was recently vaccinated, has a positive Hep B antibody titer, and you don't need to do anything in terms of post-exposure prophylaxis for those people. Now, one thing I'm gonna go ahead and say is that when a child contracts Hep B, like when a baby contracts Hep B, the vast majority of them progress to chronic Hep B. But when an adult contracts Hep B, the vast majority of them actually successfully clear the infection. That's actually a very high yield but subtle factor to keep in mind for the MBME exams, right? And how do people get Hep B, right? Like, you know, sex, needle stick injuries, like healthcare worker kind of deal, right? So those are the things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, I know one big bugaboo for many med students is that they're like, Divine, how do I memorize all these Hep B serologies? Let me tell you the thing. If you keep two rules in mind, you probably will be able to, and I'll tell you these two rules, you'll probably be able to resolve like 90 to 95% of the Hep B serology questions you get. And here are the two rules. If your Hep B surface antigen is positive, you are infected in some way, shape, or form. Okay, I'll say that again. If your Hep B surface antigen is positive, you are infected in some way, shape, or form. Now, if the second rule is that if your Hep B surface antibody is positive, then you are not infected. Okay, I'll say that again. If your Hep B surface antibody is positive, you are not infected. Like literally, if you just know those two rules, you can usually, if you just apply some reasoning, figure out exactly what they are testing in a question. Obviously, there are some more derivatives from that, but if you remember those two rules, I can almost promise you, you can probably get like 90% of your questions correct, right? So what do I mean by that, right? So say for example, a person's Hep B surface antibody is positive. You know they have no infection, right? So what are two ways you can have no infection? Well, you could have gotten the vaccine, where in that case, it's only your Hep B surface antibody that will be positive, or you could have been exposed to Hep B, but you recovered from the infection. In that case, your core antibody will be positive, right? And it will likely be like a core antibody IgG, right? Because remember, the core antibody, the core antigen that will make your body make the core antibody is not part of the vaccine. It's only part of the actual bug, right? So that's simple Hep B surface antibody business there. And then the surface antigen, right? Again, like I said, if it's positive, then you know you have an infection. And then you may say, Divine, okay, how do I know if it's an acute or chronic infection? Just look at the core antibody. That's it, right? The core antibody's job is to tell you if you've been exposed to actual Hep B, or if it's to tell you if you have like an acute or a chronic infection. If the core antibody is IgM, it's an acute infection. If the core antibody is IgG, it's a chronic infection. Simple as that. And then there's a special case of like the window period, right? In the window period, everything is negative with the exception of the Hep B core antibody. That's it. And it's usually the IgM Hep B core antibody. That's pretty much all you need to know about the Hep B serologies. And in terms of treating Hep, and remember that Hep B has like some associations with some other disorders, right? So so those disorders, you may make that those diagnoses when they tell you that, oh, this person has a history of Hep B on an NBM exam, right? Like the classic ones are like polyarteritis nodosa, right? Polyarteritis nodosa, those people tend to have like chronic abdominal pain because the vasculitis involves the mesenteric vessels in the GI tract, right? If a person has membranous nephropathy, right? Remember, that's the one that has the... It's a kind of nephrotic syndrome. It's the most common cause of nephrotic syndrome in Caucasians. Think about Hep B. You know, think about Hep B being an association there, right? Again, those are all things they love to test on exams, right? And then another thing I'd like you to keep at the back of your mind with Hep B is in terms of treatment, right? Hep B, you can treat it with like entecavir, right? Or you can treat it with tenofovir, right? So entecavir or tenofovir. In some cases, right, you may, if you don't see the, those answer choices, you may give that person like a pegylated interferon, right? Yeah, that's that, because entecavir, tenofovir, you, those things are kind of like DNA inhibitors, right? So it would not be ideal to give that to like a person that's like pregnant. That's probably not a good idea. So, you know, if a person is pregnant and they have Hep B infection, you can treat them with like a pegylated interferon. And then if a person has HIV, right, you can put them on like, I think, I'm pretty sure I talked about this in my internal medicine video. You put them on a combination of like emtricitabine and tenofovir, right? Emtricitabine and tenofovir as part of, because those things also are essentially part of antiretroviral therapy already. So it's almost like you're killing two birds with one stone, right? Now, the thing is, I'll go ahead and say this, that one way that your friends at DMM can integrate Hep B or Hep C treatment with psych is to have you remember that if a person has a history of depression, you absolutely do not want to put them on interferon alpha, right? Interferon alpha is a bad idea in a person that has a history of depression, because basically it almost puts you into like depression for a year. So if a person has a history of like major depressive disorder, or they even have like neutropenia, right? Or their cirrhosis is like super bad with like all these complications, interferon alpha is not a great idea in those people, right? Because again, remember, interferon alpha essentially spruces up your immune system, right? So if a person has like really bad cytopenias, like they have leukopenia, thrombocytopenia, anemia, interferon alpha is not great, right? Because again, you don't want to essentially like make those people have like more autoimmune destruction. Or basically, if a person has like an autoimmune thing going on, interferon alpha is bad, because in general, interferon alpha, if I'm not mistaken, I'll have to read up some more on this, it's not good in people that have autoimmune disorders. Let's just go ahead and leave it at that. And again, probably the more common likely thing you see on your exam is if a person has like major depressive disorder, that's a terrible idea, right? That's a terrible idea. And Hep C, right? Like there are some screening guideline questions that pop up on the exam periodically, right? So if, for example, a person was born between like 1945 to 1965, on your family medicine shelf, you want to make sure you screen those people for Hep C, right? And usually, again, blood transfusions are the things that give people Hep C on MDM exams, although also being an IV drug user can kind of put you in that situation. Now, one thing that the MDM also does is they may give you, again, a person, just like I said with Hep B, right? They may give you a person with a certain disease, and your next step in management on an exam may be to actually screen them for Hep C, right? Classic ones will be a person that has like mixed cryoglobulinemia, right? Remember where those people have like Raynaud's phenomenon kind of deal, right? With those cold agglutinins, right? And then another classic one is porphyria cutanea tarda, right? Remember, porphyria cutanea tarda is a deficiency of UROD, right? Like uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase. So those people, right, again, they tend to get into, there's a very strong association with Hep C, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And I mean, if you suspect the person has Hep C, the first thing you want to do on an MBM is just check the anti-HCV antibody, right? That's always your first step in diagnosis. Check the anti-HCV antibody, right? If the anti-HCV antibody is positive, then you just check the Hep C RNA, right? Because the thing is, when you know the Hep C RNA, that tells you if the person has active infection or not, right? If the Hep C RNA is negative, then the person doesn't have active infection. If the Hep C RNA is positive, then for sure they do have active infection going on, right? And the thing is, you also do all that because you need to do, you know, like genotyping, right? Before you can start them on like Hep C treatment. And the thing is, when a person gets Hep C treatment, right, you know, You can put them on one of those direct acting agents like Sophos Bouvier and Ledipas Vier. I think that's the one that's known as Harvoni that you may hear about on TV. And then you can also give like Sophos Bouvier and Semeprevir, right? So Sophos Bouvier, Ledipas Vier, Sophos Bouvier, Semeprevir. There are many other regimens, but I feel like those two I just mentioned are probably the highest yield ones to know for exams. Just basically look for drugs that end in like, that start with, look for Sophos Bouvier, right? It will likely be one of the answers you see on your test, right? So that's why you typically want to do genotyping, right? Because genotype 1 is the most common one in the US. It's like 70-ish percent of cases of Hep C, right? So you put those people on those drugs and, you know, it kind of essentially cures them. And the thing is, when a person is cured, right? When a person is cured of Hep C, the Hep C RNA will be negative. It's only the antibodies that will remain positive, right? And one weird kind of vasculitis that you may actually find in people with Hep C is something called like leukocytoclastic vasculitis, right? So those people will essentially have like palpable purpura, usually on the lower extremities, especially like the legs, right? Like the legs, the feet, right? That's one thing you want to watch out for on exams. And if a person has cirrhosis, so this is again another screening guideline thing you may see on exam, on an exam. If a person has cirrhosis and they have Hep C, you do actually need to, because they have a high risk of hepatocellular carcinoma, right? Those people actually deserve ultrasounds every 6 months, right? Just again to screen them for hepatocellular carcinoma. And then also don't forget, right, that before you start a person on like treatment for Hep C, you do actually need to check their Hep B, right? You want to check their Hep B status, right? Because the thing is, when again a person is started on antiviral therapy for Hep C, that may actually cause a reactivation of their Hep B, right? So again, just something to watch out for on an exam. And then again, if a person is an alcoholic, right, usually their AST to ALT ratio will be greater than 2-1 on an MBM exam. And then another thing you may also see is they will have like increased levels of gamma glutamyl transferase, right? And again, if a person drinks so hard that they go into acute liver failure, watch out for if their PTINR is bad or things like that. Those people may need like referral to like a transplant center, right? And usually there's this thing called like the MELD score. I would not memorize the components if I were you, or the MADRI score. Again, the thing is, people in family medicine love their scores, right? But I'm not saying to memorize the components, but I'm just saying to memorize like some numbers, right? So if, for example, a person's like MELD score is 18 or higher, right? Or their MADRI score is like 32 or higher. One thing that's usually prudent to do on MBM exams, right? Again, from alcoholism, is go ahead and give those people steroids, okay? That's just one of those weird, bizarre things you may see on an exam. Steroids have been shown to like, you know, like help with like their liver labs and almost like preserve liver function, right? So that's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind with these tests. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has a history of like Hashimoto's thyroiditis or type 1 diabetes or vitiligo or Addison's disease? And then they tell you that, oh, this person, you know, has like right upper quadrant pain, and they show you that the AST, ALT is, you know, pretty high. And they tell you that, oh, the ANE is positive on your exam. What are you thinking about? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about like autoimmune hepatitis, right? And for autoimmune hepatitis, unfortunately, your friends at the MBM expect you to know the positive autoantibodies, right? So the positive autoantibodies tend to be like the anti-smooth muscle antibodies, right? Another one you may see on an MBM exam are the anti-liver kidney microsomal antibodies, right? So anti-smooth muscle antibodies and the anti-LKM or the liver kidney microsomal antibodies. Again, it's an autoimmune disease. Remember, a pretty great majority of the time, when a person has one autoimmune disease, when they are presenting an autoimmune disease question to you on an MBM exam, they'll usually give you like some other autoimmune disease, pre-existing autoimmune disease the patient already has. And for the most part, the way you treat these people is, you know, you just give them steroids. You can also give them azathioprine. And unfortunately, whenever you stop treatment, usually the disease comes right back, right? So it's kind of an unfortunate situation there. And then again, autoimmune pancreatitis, just if they tell you that a person has like a sausage-shaped pancreas, think about autoimmune pancreatitis on MBM exams. It's one of those IgG4 related diseases where the levels of IgG4 are are kind of high, right? So that's something to keep in mind. And then what if they give you a question about like a 65-year-old man on your shelf? You know, he has erectile dysfunction. He has like this new onset diabetes. He has like skin hyperpigmentation. Or he may even have like signs and symptoms of like pituitary dysfunction. If you see that, what are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about hemochromatosis, right? Hereditary hemochromatosis. Remember, it's autosomal recessive inheritance. That's a high yield fact to know, right? And because basically these people have like, you know, they just reabsorb a crap ton of iron and all that stuff, right? And the iron then deposits in different organs, triggers the Fenton reaction, and then causes like a reactive oxygen species and like fibrotic destruction of those organs, right? So what are the classic things you may see on your exam? Skin hyperpigmentation, right? New onset diabetes in a super, like kind of like an older person. It's almost always in a guy on tests. They may also have like, because again, the iron deposits in the pancreas. Again, they may have like erectile dysfunction. They may have like CPPD, right? So calcium pyrophosphate deposition disease, right? Especially if you even see like a person having like arthritis, like in unusual areas, right? Like arthritis, like in the shoulders, in the ankles, in the elbows. And again, they have like, again, these other things I kind of talked about. Think about here hemochromatosis under those circumstances, right? And for the most part, you check these patients' transferrin saturation to, you know, kind of screen them. And then you want to know the genetic underpinnings, right, for this, right? So usually people that have hereditary hemochromatosis, they have like the C2H2Y mutation, right? So if they are homozygous for the C2H2Y mutation, or sometimes you may even find people that are like compound heterozygotes where they don't have like two C2H2Y mutations, but they have one C2H2Y mutation. And then they also have like a H63D mutation. That's what's known as a compound heterozygote that can also trigger symptoms of hereditary hemochromatosis, right? And again, sometimes you may just see them say that, oh, the person has a HFE gene mutation, right? So again, that's, these things are all just high yield and important to know for tests, right? And again, if a person has, basically when a person has like something that can cause cirrhosis, when they actually get cirrhosis, as a general principle, the screening guideline is to check those people for hepatocellular carcinoma every 6 months with ultrasound, right? And again, hemochromatosis, again, like I said, you can check the transferrin saturation. Alternatively, you can actually go ahead and check their ferritin levels. It'll be elevated. The transferrin saturation will be elevated as well, right? And the way you treat hemochromatosis is phlebotomy, right? Phlebotomy is basically your treatment for hemochromatosis, polycythemia vera, and porphyria cutanea tarda on an MBM exam, right? And then if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has like insulin resistance, person is super obese, has type 2 diabetes, and then has like, you know, like mild elevations in their AST, ALT, think about any FLD, right? So I like to call this disease NAFLD, right? NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, right? Basically, for the most part, the symptoms will resolve if you treat their diabetes, have them lose weight, treat their hyperlipidemia, and that's pretty much it. And then don't forget your classic disorders, PBC, PSC, right? PBC is going to be in a woman on your test, right? She'll have a cholestatic pattern of liver disease, so ALK-Phos will be elevated, GGT will be elevated, and don't forget your autoantibodies, right? The anti-mitochondrial antibody, right? And the thing is, because these people have these obstructive problems, they may actually have like a fat-soluble vitamin deficiency. So that's actually like an unusual kind of question you may see on your test. So they may have antecedents of like vitamin A deficiency, like night blindness, or vitamin D deficiency, where they have like osteomalacia, right? Or vitamin E deficiency, where they have like ataxia and acanthocytosis on a blood smear, or they may bleed from a vitamin K deficiency, right? And again, they can also have like osteoporosis, osteomalacia. And again, it's a problem, PBC, primary biliary cholangitis. Remember before, the old name was primary biliary cirrhosis. So PBC is something that you treat with orsodial, right? That's essentially what you do. And again, it's a problem with the intrahepatic bile ducts only, right? Contrast this with PSC that again, will show up in men, usually men with ulcerative colitis, on an MBM exam, right? And it will show up in much younger men, because PBC is usually like in women that are like 40 to 60 years old. PSC is usually in men that are 20 to 40 years old, right? Again, they almost always have UC. And unlike PBC that affects the intrahepatic bile ducts only, PSC tends to affect the intra and extrahepatic bile ducts. And again, they'll have jaundice, they'll have pruritus, their alpha will be elevated. And for the most part, right, you can make the initial diagnosis by doing an ultrasound. And then if you notice that, this person has like dilated bowel ducts, right, you can then go ahead and do an MRCP or ERCP to establish the diagnosis. And the screening things you want to keep at the back of your mind with PSA actually kind of high yield to know, right? So the thing is, these people, they have like very high risk of like colon cancer, very high risk of like gallbladder cancer, very high risk of cholangiocarcinoma. So the thing is, once a patient is diagnosed with PSC, right, you need to start screening them for colon cancer or colonoscopy at the time of diagnosis, right? And then you screen them like every 1 to 2 years. This is floridly high yield. I promise you, this is actually floridly high yield to know. Because I know some people may be saying, but Divine, I thought it was 8 years. So let me clear this up for you. If a person is diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, you start screening them with colonoscopies for colon cancer 8 years after the initial diagnosis of UC is made. But if a patient is found to have PSC, you need to start screening them from colon cancer at the moment that the diagnosis is made. And then you screen them every 1 to 2 years with a colonoscopy for colon cancer. For those people, it's usually not appropriate to do like those hemocol tests or the FIT test or whatever. You just go straight for the jugular. You go straight for a colonoscopy, right? And then these people, you also need to do like annual MRCPs, right? You need to do annual MRCPs for these people. It will help you kind of screen them for cholangiocarcinoma. And again, if they have cirrhosis with PSC, you need to consider again every 6 months ultrasound to screen for hepatocellular carcinoma, right? And again, let me real quick help you differentiate PBC, PSC. Again, PBC, woman 40 to 60 years old, affects intrahepatic bile ducts only. They usually have some other kind of autoimmune disease on board, right? They'll have positive anti-mitochondrial antibodies. You treat it ursodiol. Sometimes they may call ursodiol on exam cell, also deoxycholic acid. PSC will be in a guy that's much younger, 20 to 30-ish years old, right? They'll have, again, intra and extrahepatic bile ducts affected. They'll have a history of IBD, right? And if you do an MRCP, ERCP, you see the string of beats pattern, right? And for the most part, again, these people, don't give them ursodiol. It doesn't work, right? Essentially, the way you treat these people is you can do a liver transplant to cure, or you can use like an ERCP, or you can do like some kind of endoscopic therapy to dilate like big time strictures that are causing the patient a lot of symptoms, right? And again, you PSC, you do an ultrasound first. If it's positive, then you proceed to doing an ERCP, MRCP, right? And then if a person, you know, has a bad liver, you know, like cirrhosis, there are many classic things you see on a test, right? So they can have like hepatic encephalopathy from the buildup of an pneumonia, right? Because the urea cycle stops working. They can have ascites. They can tell you that, they'll be kind of acting weird and they have like mild abdominal pain. They have a low-grade fever. And obviously, you're thinking about SBP under those circumstances. And I hope you choose to do a paracentesis in those people and look for the more than 250 neutrophils, right? To establish the diagnosis of SBP, right? And then don't forget, right? These people can have like hepatorenal syndrome. They can get hepatopulmonary syndrome and all that stuff. And for the most part, right, like again, they can have like big spleens from portal hypertension, if your spleen is big, right, remember your spleen I think can sequester up to 30% of your total platelet pool, right? So those people can have a thrombocytopenia with that, right? And then obviously they'll have like low levels of albumin, they'll have like bleeding problems, right? Because again, they're not able to make adequate amounts of clotting factors. So some things, right, with cirrhosis, right? So again, hepatic encephalopathy, right? Again, the patient will have like, you know, like all these weird cognitive issues. They may be comatose. There are many things that can trigger it, right? So they may have like an infection. They may have a GI bleed, right? Those things can all trigger hepatic encephalopathy. And the way you treat hepatic encephalopathy, right, you give lactulose. If they're not responding very well to lactulose, you can consider giving those people rifaximin on a test. Right, and then if they give you a question about a person that has cirrhosis, and you know this person is like short of breath, their arterial oxygen tension is low, so they have like an increased AA gradient, and then they tell you that when the person sits up, they feel super short of breath. When they lie back, their shortness of breath gets better. If you see that, think about hepatopulmonary syndrome, right? That's basically that thing I just described is what's known as like orthodeoxia platypnea syndrome, right? It's classic for hepatopulmonary syndrome. And the way you make the diagnosis of hepatopulmonary syndrome is actually to go ahead and get an echocardiogram. And then if they tell you that a person has like, you know, like very elevated, again, shortness of breath, but you don't necessarily have any pulmonary edema, but you notice that the arrived ventricular pressures are real high, right? And you have cirrhosis. You want to think about portopulmonary hypertension. So portopulmonary hypertension under those circumstances, again, those people need an echocardiogram. Yeah, it's a bad situation for the most part. And then hepatorenal syndrome, right? Again, you see a person that has cirrhosis and their creatinine, you know, kind of keeps rising. And the thing is, when they give you urine labs in those people, their urine labs look exactly like pre-renal isotemia kind of labs. I kind of explained the pathophysiology behind this in one of my GI Step 1 podcasts, but I don't think pathophysiology is like super necessary. Basically, like when a person is cirrhotic, they may have like splanchnic vasodilation. So that will steal perfusion away from the kidneys, right? So they're hypoperfusing the kidneys. So essentially those people, like their kidneys have like completely normal anatomy, completely normal architecture, right? But their kidneys are just failing, right? That's classic for hepatorenal syndrome. And then don't forget, right? Like again, if you have like liver disease, you're not going to be able to make calcidiol, which on MBM is the occasionally called a 25-hydroxy vitamin D. So if you're not able to do any of those things, right, you're not going to be able to make, because there's nothing that you can send to the kidneys, right, to act on throw one alpha hydroxylase to make calcitriol. So your calcium will be low, your phosphate will be low because you don't have active vitamin D. That will raise your parathyroid hormone levels, right, and that will begin, again, to resorb your bone and all that stuff. So you can have like osteoporosis, osteopenia, or you can get like an osteodystrophy, right? So again, those are all just high yield to keep in mind. Essentially, those people have like a secondary hyperparathyroidism. And really, the way you treat these people is you give them calcitriol, right? Or you can give them calcidiol, and that one is fine. And typically, what you do is, if they have osteoporosis, right? You know, consider giving them bisphosphonate for the most part, like you normally would do for osteoporosis, right? And since we're kind of talking about cirrhosis, let me just maybe talk about the GI bleed algorithm. It's something that people tend to get wrong, and it kind of hurts my heart. I don't want that to be the case. GI bleeds are easy pickings on MBM exams. They are always easy points because they are treated the same way. Upper, lower GI bleed doesn't matter, right? The reason I'm talking about a GI bleed now, I'm talking about cirrhosis, is, well, literally, people that are cirrhotic are at high risk of bleeding, right, from esophageal varices. If a person comes in with a GI bleed, right, oh, they are vomiting blood, pooping blood, or whatever, the first thing you do is you insert two large peripheral IVs. That's it. That's the first step. Second step, give them fluids. If they are hemodynamically unstable and, you know, fluids are not cutting it, you can give them some blood. And then the third thing is you just do upper endoscopy, right? You do an EGD, an esophageal gastroduodenoscopy, right? If the EGD shows you what you're looking for, you intervene and you're done. But if the EGD does not show you what you're looking for, your next step is a colonoscopy on an exam. And then if your colonoscopy is wrong, then one thing you can do is you can do like a tagged red blood cell scan or anything of that sort, right? So again, these are all things to keep in mind for the purposes of these exams. And then, again, SVP, you do parts and TCs. I already kind of talked about that already. And don't forget your SAG gradient, right? Don't forget your SAG gradient. If your SAG gradient is more than 1.1, then basically anything that increases hydrostatic pressures or decreases oncotic pressures in your bloodstream will cause, like, those are, I almost think of, like, a SAG gradient being greater than 1.1 as almost like a transudate kind of ascites, right? So it's like low oncotic pressure, high hydrostatic pressure, things that give rise to these problems, right? So things like if a person has, like cirrhosis, or they have like Budd-Chiari syndrome, or like right-sided heart failure from like RC infarct or something like that, right? And then if it's less than 1.1, if your serum ascites albumin gradient is less than 1.1, then you're, so SAAG, right? You're worried about like cancer for the most part, right? Cancer for the most part. And again, if a person has cirrhosis, please don't forget, like I think this is probably like the fourth time I'm saying this, right? Please don't get this wrong on a test. If a person has cirrhosis, you need to screen them for hepatocellular carcinoma every 6 months with an ultrasound, right? And then, so let's talk about how you treat like some of these bad things with cirrhosis, right? So if, for example, again, you want to prophylax a person like against like a variceal bleed, right? The best thing you can do on an NBM exam is to consider giving like a beta blocker, a non-selective beta blocker, right? So like propranolol, nidolol. You can also use like carvedilol, right? I remember carvedilol is an alpha beta blocker, right? And then, if for example that's not an option, let's say for example they have like a history of like severe asthma or severe reactive airway disease, then you can prophylactically do like upper endoscopy and do like a band ligation of those varices, right? And then if a person is like, you know, bleeding like an active variceal bleed, again, kind of like what I said already, peripheral IVs, fluids plus or minus blood, EGD to intervene, right? And typically, right, there are some drugs you need to give, and these drugs are kind of high yield to know on exams, right? You want to go ahead and give those people IV octreotide, right? And then you also need to place them on like prophylactic antibiotics. It's usually of the fluoroquinolone variety, right? So you can give them like norfloxacin, you can give them ciprofloxacin, you can even give them ceftriaxone actually. And then let's say you try all those things, you've done the band ligation, nothing is working, then you have to call interventional radiology. Those people need a TIPS procedure, right? They need a TIPS procedure. Although remember that TIPS, right, one common complication is hepatic encephalopathy, because you're essentially connecting, putting a conduit between the hepatic artery and the between the portal vein and the hepatic vein, right? That's great. That's that's great and all, right? But you do need to be mindful of the fact that you're essentially bypassing the liver, you're bypassing the urea cycle, so those people can get a hyperammonemia. If a person is bleeding, right, and again, if the hemoglobin is less than 7, you need to give them blood, right? To help with like the ascites, right? You can give them like spironolactone, you can give them like Lasix, right? So like furosemide. And if you notice that this person's ascites, right, like you've tried diuretics, you've tried everything, doesn't seem to be working, they still keep building up a ton of like ascitic fluid. One smart thing you can actually do on an NBM exam is to do like serial paracentesis, like serial, like large volume of paracentesis. And one magic number you probably want to remember here is 5 liters. If you strip a person of more than 5 liters of ascitic fluid, you need to give them albumin, right? You need to give them albumin. And again, if you want to prophylax against SBP, give fluoroquinolones. That's kind of like the big thing you should take away from that. Or if a person has SBP, for the most part, SBP is treated with albumin plus a third generation cephalosporin, so like ceftriaxone, cefotaxime kind of deal, right? And again, I've talked about hepatic encephalopathy. You give lactulose first. If that doesn't cut it, you add rifaximine. Remember, rifaximine is an RNA polymerase inhibitor. But as far as I know, it's extremely expensive. And yeah, I feel like I've pretty much talked about most problems with people that have cirrhosis, right? So I think I'm going to go ahead and kind of pause there. And then again, acute liver injury, right? Like these people just, usually it's some toxin or some drug, usually acetaminophen. Their AST, ALT just go through the roof like really quickly, right? Acute liver injury can lead you to acute liver failure, right? Where you begin to have like encephalopathy, your PTINR, your PTT goes out of whack, that's bad, right? And again, for the most part, what are the things that cause acute liver injury on NBM exams? Acetaminophen, big one, right? Sometimes drug reactions, right? Acute viral hepatitis, right? Another one may be also be if a person like consumes mushrooms. Remember, like mushrooms contain like Amanita, A-M-A-N-I-T-A, right? Amanita, like mushrooms and all that stuff, right? So, you know, just kind of watch out for those things, right? So, and also if a person has like systemic hypotension, right? That can cause like massive elevation in AST, ALT. That's something that people call like shock liver, right? So that those are all things to watch out for in your test, right? So basically, right, if you see a person with acetaminophen overdose, your next step in management on an NBM exam is, you know, measure the serum acetaminophen level, right? And then go ahead and, you know, use a nomogram to see if they qualify for N-acetylcysteine. If a person has like hepatitis A, right, and it's causing like acute liver injury, you know, just supportive care, give them fluids, give them antiemetics. That's pretty much all you can do. There's no like real antibiotic treatment, right? And then, if they give you a question about a person that has like elevated AST, ALT, and the person has like psych style, maybe like this history of like psych style problems, Parkinsonian problems, like choriform movements, and they tell you that, oh, they have like Kaiser Fleischer rings in the eye, may not be a bad idea to consider Wilson's disease, right? Usually for those people, you measure their levels of serum copper, you measure their ceruloplasmin levels. And you can also even check their urine copper excretion. And the way you treat that, right, you treat that with like trientine, right? Or you can treat them with penicillamine. Trientine is T-R-I-E-N-T-I-N-E. That's high iotonol. Remember, trientine, though, cannot just chelate copper, it can chelate zinc, right? So if they give you a question about a person with a history of Wilson's disease that's well controlled with medication, and then they have like alopecia, and they have like poor wound healing, you know, like or a rash on the skin, now think about a zinc deficiency from the medications they are taking. Again, those are all high yield things to know. And then mushroom poisoning, for the most part, right? Like you want to think about giving those people like a penicillin G, right? That's a thing that it's unusual. I can pretty much opine that most people get it wrong on a test, but you won't get it wrong because you listen to and paid attention to this podcast. And then some of these like pregnancy related squibbles, right? Again, remember your family medicine exam, right, has OB questions. That's one of those things you should expect, right? So, you know, be able to identify some of these liver associated OB GYN pathologies, right? So like hyperemesis gravidarum, right? You'll be a first trimester woman that has like severe vomiting, right? The ALT is usually pretty elevated, and these people are actually at risk of Wernicke's encephalopathy. So you typically want to go ahead and give them like IV thiamine, and you usually check their ketone levels when they come into the hospital, right? And the way you treat these people, you hydrate them, right? You give them antiemetics, you give them IV thiamine, and then you tell them, you know, when you go home, eat smaller meals. You can give them like vitamin B6 plus doxylamine. That also usually helps as well, right? And then if they give you a question about a woman like in the second or third trimester, she has like really bad pruritus, and then they show you some labs, you notice that the ALT is like super high, the ALK force is super high, but other than that, she has no other symptoms other than like the pruritus and stuff. You want to think about like intrahepatic cholestasis. And your treatment of choice on NBM exams actually is orsodial, right? So remember, orsodial is useful for like two things on exams, PBC and intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy. PBC meaning primary biliary cholangitis, right? And then if they give you a question about a woman that, you know, her blood pressure is really high, she has like lower extremity edema, has protein positive in her urine, that's preeclampsia, right? Those people, you want to, you know, kind of be careful. You want to be looking towards delivering the baby, right? And again, this would be a third trimester problem, not a second trimester, third trimester problem on your exam. And then obviously, right, if a person has, you know, like antecedents of preeclampsia, but you notice that they have like an indirect type of hyperbilirubinemia, they have like low platelets and all that stuff, that's HELLP syndrome, H-E-L-L-P. This one is bad, right? You want to go ahead and deliver the child quickly. And then obviously, if a person has eclampsia, right, you give IV magnesium and deliver the baby, right? Magnesium helps with the seizures. It's been shown to be better than benzos, right, in treating the seizures that are associated with preeclampsia, right? And then if they give you a question again, and again, HELLP syndrome being the third trimester. So again, hyperemesis gravidarum, first trimester. Intrahepatic cholestasis, second or third trimester. All these other pathologies I'm mentioning are all third trimester problems, right? So if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has like severe, you know, like signs of like preeclampsia, has like severe abdominal pain, feeling nauseous, AST, ALT crazy high, low platelets, indirect hyperbilirubinemia, they have like an encephalopathy, they have like, you know, their liver function is just all out of whack, PTT is high, INR is high, and it's like acute onset, think about acute fatty liver of pregnancy. They may even have hypoglycemia on an NBM exam. You need to go ahead and deliver that baby pronto. Right? So I know some of you may be saying, okay, Divine, how do I differentiate HELLP syndrome from acute fatty liver of pregnancy? For the most part, HELLP syndrome tends to have like, those people tend to have more of like a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, but acute fatty liver of pregnancy, they tend to be like comatose, they tend to have like many liver function lab anomalies like PT, PTT out of whack, and they also tend to have like an encephalopathy, right? And then one thing I want to go through with you real quick. Again, I'm going to end this podcast very soon, I promise. If they give you a question about a patient, so let's just run through these vignettes real quick. Like a patient that has like right upper quadrant pain, or sometimes on NBM is to be deceitful, they'll put that this person has epigastric pain, right? And then you notice that this person's, you know, has like fever, but they have no jaundice. And their AST, ALT just mildly elevated. If you see that, And maybe they say, oh, they get an ultrasound. And you see like a thickened gallbladder wall, pericholecystic fluid. This is acute cholecystitis, right? Remember, for those people, you get a right upper quadrant ultrasound first. If that's equivocal, you get a HIDA scan, right? And you treat it with a cholecystectomy, right? And then if, for example, the person has intermittent right upper quadrant pain, you do an ultrasound, you don't see any gallstones. That person has something called biliary sludge, right? Or say, for example, they give you a question about a patient. Sorry, I'm just running through these quick because I may actually need to run to somewhere soon. If they give you a question about a person that has fever of 103, right upper quadrant pain, jaundice, that's Charcot's triad, right? You know this ascending cholangitis, or they may add altered mental status hypotension, then that's renal Spentad. Your first step in management and diagnosis for those people is boom, go straight for an ERCP. Okay, that's you're not gonna be doing an ultrasound, and then you're gonna give them broad spectrum antibiotics, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient that is super ill, stuck in the ICU, super septic, right? And they have right upper quadrant pain, they have a mild fever, and you check their ultrasound. You don't see any gallstones or whatever. But you may see pericholecystic fluid and all that stuff. If you see that, I would hope you're thinking about acalculous cholecystitis. The way you treat that is you do a cholecystostomy, right? You don't do a cholecystectomy, right? That's bad. You do a cholecystostomy, you call interventional radiology. They put a tube in there to kind of drain and decompress the gallbladder, right? Again, if a patient has epigastric pain going to the back, that's pancreatitis. If they have the classic pattern of abdominal pain and elevated lipase, threefold upper limit of normal, then that's kind of bad, right? So you don't need to get any kind of imaging. You just make them MPO, so they're not eating anymore. You give them pain control. You give them a ton of fluid, right? That's pretty much it. And then don't forget your rancing criteria. I'll encourage you to look those up, right? If those people are hypocalcemic, their calcium is low, right? Or they have a big decrease in their hemoglobin, or their AST is markedly elevated, or their LDH is markedly elevated, or they have a leukocytosis, their white count is more than 16,000. Those are all poor prognostic factors, right? In a person that has acute pancreatitis. And then if they give you a question about a patient, right, that, has bilateral adnexal tenderness, they tell you that this person has purulent vaginal discharge, and they have right upper quadrant pain, I would hope you're thinking about Fitzhugh Curtis syndrome, right? That's essentially a perihepatitis from chlamydia or gonorrhea. Obviously, you want to give those people ceftriaxone and azithromycin or ceftriaxone plus doxycycline. And then if they give you a question about a patient, they tell you that, oh, this patient has usually they will give you the imaging finding in these kinds of questions. They tell you that, oh, this patient's common hepatic duct is dilated, and you notice that there is a gallstone in the cystic duct, and they have jaundice, right? Because jaundice is not a classic finding. People will call it cystitis, right? So if you see a person that has a stone obstructing the cystic duct, you're divine, but that should be cholecystitis. But you notice that they have jaundice, right? And they tell you in the question that, oh, their hepatic ducts are dilated. That's something known as Mirizzi syndrome, M-I-R-I-Z-Z-I. That's something that you may also see on a surgery shelf, actually, right? And then if a person, has a history of intermittent right upper quadrant pain, and then they for the last 2 days, they've been having vomiting, basically small bowel obstruction symptoms, I would hope you're thinking about a cholecystoenteric fistula, right? They've essentially formed a fistula between the gallbladder and the GI tract, usually the distal small bowel, and then a stone has traveled and obstructed the small bowel under those circumstances, right? So again, those are just kind of big things to keep at the back of your mind. I don't know, is there any other thing I want to talk about? I think I've pretty much talked about everything I want to say. Well, let me just say some real quick things, right? So if they give you a question about an old person that has a painless lower GI bleed, that's diverticulosis, right? You can do barium studies to make the diagnosis. You can also do a CT scan. If you see a person over the age of 50 that has an iron deficiency anemia with hemocore positive stools, right, that's colon cancer, that's pretty easy. Or they may even have a colonic angiodysplasia. And then if they give you a question about a patient that has a history of AFib and they have sudden onset severe abdominal pain, right, you want to think about acute mesenteric ischemia under those circumstances, right? And then if you notice the person has GI bleeds or hemocore positive stools, And they tell you in the Q-stem that the person has a history of, like, aortic stenosis. You want to think about, like, something called Heide syndrome, like H-E-Y-D-E. It's like an angiodysplasia, right? You want to do, like, some kind of colonoscopy or something to find, like, the vascular problem there, right? And then if they tell you that, oh, a person has GI bleeds and they've had, like, a AAA fixed in the past, that's something known as an aortoenteric fistula, right? And then if you see, like, a very young person on your test, like a young kid with, like, you know, painless, like bloody poop, think about Meckel's diverticulum, you know, do like a technetium scan, like the Meckel scan, you usually find the lesion in the right lower quadrant, right? And then if you notice that a person has all these bleeding and then they have especially like on their lips, they have like these telangiectasias, you want to think about a hemorrhagic, like hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia. I think that's what's also known as like Osler-Weber-Rundle syndrome, right? So just something to keep in mind. So I think I'm going to go ahead and pause here, as I do at the end of every podcast, for 101 tutoring for a ton of exams. Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams, basically all the medicine residency exams, like the in-training, the ABIM boards. And then I do these booster courses. It's 15 hours for 2CK and Step 3, 20 hours for Step 1. Basically, it's a couple of sessions, one-on-one, rapid fire. We review the must knows for those exams. Done it with a ton of people. They found it to be really helpful. And then if you're a college student or you need MCAT tutoring, like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I tutor for all those things. And then I also do like coaching, right, for like if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERASAP, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCASAP. Again, I do offer like one-on-one tutoring and coaching for those things. Again, I have like 1 year's worth of admissions committee experience at a top 2 med school, right? So if you need like help in any of those areas, or you know someone that needs help in any of those areas, just go ahead and have them reach out to me. And then also I'm going to be starting this private study group soon. I'll probably hold it like weekly, but it's going to come up soon. I'll put out some more information on that soon. It'll be like a nominal fee, usually be for like an hour or two, right? And if you sign up, right, there'll usually be like a theme where I cover like cardiology or this or that. And again, I suspect it's something that people will find helpful. I've done this many times in the past. That's something I want to study. It'll probably be through Zoom or some kind of good online medium. So if you're interested in any of these things, reach out to me either through the website, Divine Intervention. Reach out to me either through the website, or you can send me an email, Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end, @gmail.com. And please subscribe to the YouTube channel, the podcast website, and I also have all these podcasts on like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play. So please feel free to subscribe. I appreciate any extra subscription. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.